You are listening to a free version of Majority Report with Sam Steeder. To support the show and get another 15 minutes of daily program, go to majority.fm, please.
The Majority Report with Sam Steeder.
It is Tuesday, May 9th, 2017. My name is Michael Brooks, and I'm Michael Tuesday. This is the four-time award-winning Majority Report. We're broadcasting live steps from the industrially ravaged Gowanus Canal in the heartland of America, downtown Brooklyn, USA. On today's program, Stephen Cook to discuss his new book, False Dawn, Protest, Democracy, and Violence in the New Middle East. And Avi Asher Shapiro. As Uber probes sexual harassment in its offices, it overlooks hundreds and thousands of female drivers. We're talking about the Uber harassment culture of woman drivers. This is new investigative piece in The Intercept. Republicans, they keep lying on health care. That's their answer for passing a ghoulish and grotesque assault on America's well-being. Lie. We're not cutting Medicaid. They won't hurt you if you have pre-existing conditions. We won't charge you more. This doesn't jeopardize your health care. This doesn't make it more expensive for you if you're over 50. This doesn't apply to vindictive new pre-existing condition rules. None of that. They just lie and lie and lie. Donald Trump and Paul Ryan on down. South Korea elects a new president, a human rights lawyer, progressive liberal, the first center-left leader in South Korea. For 9 years, he promises a diplomatic approach to North Korea, potentially splitting a right-wing united front between the United States and South Korea. Maybe not a moment too soon. Sally Yates testifying. Republicans running interference. Was Mike Flynn not the only one that might have been compromised by potentially inappropriate contacts with the Russians? Probably not. That's going to lead us to a conversation about arguably one of the most powerful men in American government. We're going to really take it to that sycophantic young trust fund baby consigliere, Jared Kushner, get to his role in all of this, his family background, how exactly he got into Harvard. Hillary Clinton, she's launching a PAC, simply will not go away, so we're going to need to revisit, sadly, some of the failures of that campaign, so that hopefully we can move forward. And not only did Sally Yates reveal that Michael Flynn was likely compromised in that hearing, she also owned the ever-repulsive Ted Cruz on the Muslim ban. That was a great moment. All that and more on today's Majority Report. We're running late. We're a person down today here. Matt has returned from Miami. And really,
it's good to be back.
Welcome back. I hope you can keep your glow going for another day or two at least.
I'm trying.
All right. That spoke volumes. Hey, Casper is an obsessively engineered mattress at shockingly fair price. It's the mattress of choice for Matt. And I know that Matt was very upset. That was the worst part of being in Miami for him, was that he wasn't on his Casper.
That's right.
Supportive memory foam creates an award-winning sleep service with just the right sink and just the right bounce. Try Casper for 100 nights risk-free in your own home. If you don't love it, they'll pick it up, refund you everything. Casper understands the importance of truly sleeping on a mattress before you commit, especially considering you're going to spend a third of your life on it. Free shipping and returns to U.S. and Canada with over 1,000-plus reviews and an average of 4.8 stars. It's quickly becoming the internet's favorite mattress.
I could just use a sleepy metaphor. I slept right through that 100 days.
Yes. Matt is a devotee. The next time I re-up, it's definitely going to be a Casper. purchase by visiting casper.com/majority, casper.com/majority, and using offer code majority. That's offer code majority. We will be right back with Stephen Cook on the Majority Report. Welcome back to the Majority Report. I'm Michael Brooks. Joining us now is Stephen A. Cook. He's a senior fellow at the Council on Foreign Relations, author of the just-released False Dawn, Protest, Democracy, and Violence in the New Middle East. It was inspired by the clash. Steve, how are you doing?
All right, what's going on, man? How are you?
I'm doing well, man. Always a pleasure to be talking with you.
Same here. It's the new Middle East, actually. That's what I wanted it to be called. Protest, democracy, and violence in the new Middle East.
Right.
I think for the last 15 years, we've had a new Middle East every 5 years or so.
Right. Right. Exactly. So this is actually be transparent in the outset. This is a very, it's a depressing book. It's a very smart book. It's a very important book. It's a very well-reasoned book, which are usually words that you cannot describe to most books that are published in America about the Middle East, but it's a very depressing one. But you have four different countries that you examine the sort of false dawn through, and I think everybody's familiar to some extent. We'll get to the post-2011 ones, but you start with Turkey and the false dawn of, you know, and think out, now everybody knows there's this global reputation of Erdogan as a strongman. But when he and his AKP government came into power in 2003, I believe it was, very different, a sense of possibility and global reputation.
Oh, that's exactly right. That's exactly right. Let me first speak to the whole false, you know, the whole depressing aspect of it. I mean, I'm absolutely going to cop to that, you know. And I've thought about that in thinking about how to cast a book. I mean, how many people want to read a book that is so incredibly, it's frustrating, it's uncertain, it can be depressing at moments. And I think, you know, the book is my response to the kind of irrational exuberance that was met with, in particular, the uprisings around the Arab world. And I think that as analysts, as journalists covering the story, as editors, as other observers, people tended to get carried away. And this was my effort of sort of setting the record straight and understanding exactly what it was we expected and what was realistic. And the argument's not Arabs and Muslims can't be live in democracies and can't forge democracies, but that the people in the now famous squares around the region faced enormous obstacles, which we probably should have picked up on almost immediately, but in the kind of, it's 1989 and the fall of communism all over again, collectively we all thought it would be a little easier than it's actually been. And I think, you know, the other thing is, it's also, it's a human story. It's a story about people struggling for their freedom. And in many ways, that struggle has transformed people throughout the region and transformed the way in which we analyze the region. The unfortunate thing is, it has not, it doesn't have a very good outcome. And I think Turkey is a perfect example, although Turkey didn't have the kind of mass uprising
right.
that it had in
No, Turkey
Egypt
happened
Egypt
through the happened through the ballot box, but it was sort of
exactly.
like, you know, and it probably also because it happened through the ballot box, it was thought of as like, wait, this is a, and you know, we always say this caveat, and I certainly do, that it's not exactly like, you know, I'm a liberal, I'm a left-wing guy, so my political preference is not a, you know, a center-right, religiously infused party. But that said, when AKP first came to power, it was kind of revolutionary just in the sense that, like, this is the Islamic yeah. Christian Democrats. And that's a major
right.
step forward for what we conceive of as Islamic politics and Islam and democracy in Turkey. And that was what people thought they were bringing to the table.
And that's exactly what the Justice and Development Party, this AKP, you're using the Turkish acronym for it, that's exactly what the Justice and Development Party told its international interlocutors, that it was the Muslim analog of Christian Democrats. And in the first 2-3 years that the AKP was in power, it passed a number of important constitutional reform packages that made Turkey more open, raised the prospect of Turkey actually making a transition to democracy, and led to an invitation from the European Union to begin negotiations to join the union. Now, it's hard to argue. It's hard to argue with those things. And
right.
but the there was a number of problems that cropped up almost immediately. The Europeans actually never expected the Turks to fulfill any criteria that they set out to begin negotiations, and they did. And almost immediately, the French government, the Austrian government, the government of the Republic of Cyprus, half of which that island, half of which is occupied by Turkish forces, immediately rejected Turkey's bid, and within a few months had frozen chapters of what's called the acquis communautaire, mm-hmm. which is basically the body of European law that everybody has to agree to, and that it has to be negotiated. And
in order to harmonize with the European Union.
Right, in order to harmonize. And this was a huge setback.
Right.
And I think that the Turkish leadership spoke bravely about continuing the reform process. But really, Europe, for all of its problems, had kind of anchored the reforms that the Turks had undertaken in the years leading up to this invitation. And so that was one problem. Another problem that cropped up was in 2007, the military, it wasn't quite a coup, but the military, which had been extraordinarily influential in Turkish politics and had undertaken 4 coups d'etat in 40 years, tried to prevent the AKP's choice to become president from actually becoming the president.
Right.
I mean, this was seen as kind of a coup. And so after elections in 2007, Erdogan's shifted from being someone who forged a purposely broad coalition to one that was narrower and narrower in an effort to undermine any and all opponents, real and perceived. And from kind of 2007 on, there was this politics of polarization and a real return of authoritarian politics in Turkey, where Erdogan basically was like, I'm going to do unto them before they can do unto me.
Right.
Because he was convinced a coup was around the corner. And of course, this past July, there actually was an attempted coup.
Right. Although, you know, so at the same time that Turkey is regressing, and I like that, you know, you make it the point very well that again, this is not like a confirmation that there couldn't be an Islamic Christian Democratic version party. What you're just showing in some ways was that, I mean, first of all, I think obviously Erdogan as a personality has his own dictatorial tendencies, and he is more important than the party, to say the least. But also right. that, you know, he's conforming to Turkish politics in some ways, just the kind of Islamic version versus the secular version. Now, if the choice is, you know, two authoritarian systems, I'd pick the secular one. But we thought we were progressing into something new. At the same time, that's right. happening in Turkey. You know, these movements are starting in the Middle East, and Turkey is one of the examples. And you talk about Tunisia, Egypt, Libya. Can you mm-hmm. just kind of run us through? Because, I mean, okay, so, you know, Tunisia is the place, the first place it happens. It's small, it's inspiring, it's still less known, it still gets the most positive rap. Egypt, you know, major global coverage, big story, then it seems like there's a reversal, and then Libya kind of becomes, you know, basically seems like just another kind of, you know, Western military intervention that was ill-conceived, and, you know, so how did those three things play out? What are the different dynamics in those three places?
Right.
And where are we at now? Right. And yeah.
But, you know, you said something very, very interesting about Turkey, and I know you intended to.
Always.
That, you know, it's two different kinds of authoritarian systems. What's interesting about it, and what is a real tragedy of Turkey's trajectory over the course of the last 10 years or so, is that when Erdogan and the AKP came to power, the party was first elected in late 2002, and Erdogan became the prime minister in 2003. They came to power promising to undo and to raise the kind of authoritarian pillars of the Turkish state and to undo those authoritarian methods that were used to repress them and,
right.
and the people that they represent. And here they are, a decade or more later, availing themselves of the same tools that were used against them. And that's really an incredible tragedy about Turkey. In the late 90s, when I was still a grad student, there was always this talk about how far was Turkey from democratic consolidation. And I would make the argument that what are we even talking about here? Democratic consolidation kind of suggests that the country's already a democracy.
Right.
That certainly wasn't the case. And we're even further away from that place that people thought they were in the mid and late 1990s than ever before. I mean, Erdogan's really taken Turkey further away than anybody had even expected that he might.
Right.
Anyway, on this question of the Egyptians and the Libyans and the Tunisians, I mean, look, Egypt was the big deal here, as you point out.
Right.
No, Egyptian leaders aren't chased from office. They're, you know, everlasting monuments to them are built. They're called the pyramids.
right.
And so it was supposed to have this kind of dynamic effect on the region. And yeah, it was one thing when Zine El Abidine Ben Ali, Tunisia's strongman of almost 30 years, was chased from power. But Tunisia is small. It's a country of 10 and a half, maybe 11 million people. It's about the size of Florida with less international influence than Florida.
Right.
And it was, and it's always been kind of an outlier in the region. And that's, in part, one of the reasons why we think about it as being a success, because it's supposed to be an outlier when it's not really. Tunisia is neither a success nor a failure. It's more of a country on the edge, which is how I kind of present it in the book. But Egypt, because it felt so revolutionary and so different, because in 18 days, Egyptians did what no one thought they could ever do, which is rise up and depose a leader.
Right.
Then suddenly it felt like the entire Middle East was in play. If the Egyptians could dislodge the modern-day pharaoh, then it was wide open. Anything could possibly happen, and it felt quite revolutionary. But, of course, it wasn't, because it wasn't actually a revolution at all. And what you had was you had a leadership change, but mm-hmm. the kind of political institutions and the social structures that supported those political institutions remained intact. I mean, who came to power after Mubarak fell? It was the military.
Right.
Mubarak had come from the military. Sadat had come from the military. Nasser had come from it. So it hadn't changed. Street politics had changed Egypt to some extent, but once the military and the social classes that supported, you know, regain the initiative, it was pretty much over. The interregnum with Morsi was not likely to last.
That was the Muslim Brotherhood, who came into power briefly in elections after Egypt, after the removal of Mubarak.
Right, and what happened was with Mohamed Morsi, the Muslim Brotherhood leader, was there was this sense on the part of the military and the elite that they could somehow contain the Brotherhood.
Right.
As he was coming to power, they stripped him of his powers with regard to national security and national defense.
Right.
The judiciary dissolved the parliament, all kinds of things like that to kind of box in the Brotherhood. But in the end, they decided they couldn't possibly do it. And they were able to marshal millions and millions of people in the streets against Mohamed Morsi in support of the coup. And, you know, in the coup in July 2013, and Egypt's been on this resurgent authoritarian trajectory ever since. It's like Mubarak on steroids. And then, of course, Libya was the astonishing thing about Libya was when Gaddafi fell and then was subsequently killed in October 2011, there was this sense here in Washington and elsewhere that because Libya was a blank slate in ways that, you know, Gaddafi didn't bequeath the country any kind of formal institutions, certainly not the kind of institutions that would-be revolutionaries in Egypt confronted, that it would be almost easy to build a new democracy in Libya because the obstacles were less. Mm. But what you had was you had fragmentation. You had fragmentation. And the person who predicted this, it's amazing. Remember in February 2011, I mean, everybody was glued to their televisions as this all this stuff was going on. And Muammar Gaddafi's son, Saif al-Islam al-Gaddafi, people got to know in the West, he was allegedly the reformer and so on and so on. He popped up on television 5 days after the Libyan uprising began. And everybody remembers that he said, "We will fight to the last man, woman, and bullet." And everybody's kind of like freaked out by that. Oh my God, we thought he was a reformer. And look what he's saying. But you know what he also said that night? He said, "Libyans, we are not Egyptians. We are not Tunisians. We will fight for the next 40 years. And that seems to be what transpired. I mean, you had this almost immediate militarization and fragmentation of the country. And these are the kind of four different outcomes that I think are important for people to understand, none of which are good, some of which are quite tragic. And that's why it's called a false dawn. There was so much enthusiasm and expectations about the future, but we didn't understand actually the dynamics as well as perhaps we should have to recognize that, Libya wasn't a blank slate upon which to build democracy, but it was this fragmentation that was, as you point out, helped along by an ill-conceived military mission there that was supposed to protect the people of Benghazi, Libya's second city, but ended up really being about regime change.
And also had another dimension that is distinct about Libya. And I remember, the former South African president, Thabo Mbeki, gave an address about this in 2013, where he said, people made a big deal of the Arab League endorsing military action, but the AU, the African Union, didn't. And they, even though they also put together their own diplomatic package, nobody was saying this is fine that, Gaddafi engages in mass atrocities. Everybody at that point had some type of approach to restraining Gaddafi. But when the UN went along with the Arab League version, it also sort of dislodged Libya as an Arab country. It's also an African country. An interesting, I guess, there's a lot of questions there. One is that
my sense is the Africans understood Libya better than the Arabs. In a lot of ways, Libya was a black box. Gaddafi had been at odds with fellow Arab leaders, had opened up broadly to Libya. Gaddafi wanted to make himself the king of United Africa, so he would spread the money around. I think just Africans just had a better idea of what Libya was like than what the Emiratis and the Qataris and others and the United States.
Well, they seem to understand that, correct me if I'm wrong, that it's like okay, so on one hand with Gaddafi, there's these revolutionary delusions of grandeur, and he has he had an incredibly cruel, vicious, eccentric dictatorship. But at the end of the day, and in some ways, maybe in certain ways, Libya is more analogous to Syria in this sense, that yes, Egypt and Tunisia, for all of the repression and cruelty, had, you know, there are bureaucratic states there. And really what Libya was a fusion of an eccentric, strongman, brutal dictatorship, and then, you know, basically ethnic and group-based politics that kept different groups in power and different patronage networks. And then without centralization, you know, that all just devolves. And that's what you're seeing now. And just like with Iraq and just like with many other places that we've intervened in, we don't, you know, America seems to either kind of be comfortable with a dictator or a royal family to back, or there's like this sense of intervention without an understanding of, like, you know, hey, there are different groups here. There are different, you know, if you go into New York City, even in, you know, obviously it's a radically different situation, but it's like, you know, like, well, wait, what part of Williamsburg do you represent? Because you could be representing ultra-Orthodox, you know, Jews, or you could be representing a group that's, you know, primarily new migrants from Latin America or immigrants from Latin America, you could be in WASP neighborhood, or hipsters, or Jews and, you know, Orthodox and hipsters, right? Like that's, yeah, exactly. So there's this, so if you're going into places with similar dynamics, particularly in Libya, and it seems like it's just a complete misread, and the Africans did seem to understand, like, wait a second, this isn't exactly how this place is run. There's Gaddafi, but then there's all these rings of influence and groups around it.
Right, and I think that's an incredibly important point, is that you had the kind of formal politics in which Gaddafi didn't really have a role. You know, you had this direct democracy, and there were actually pretty elaborate processes and institutions set up around it, but that's not actually the way Libya was run. It was run through this clique of Gaddafi loyalists and loyalist kind of tribes and regions to him. For everybody else, this system that did not work, people relied on their region and their tribe. So it stands to reason, once Gaddafi was gone and that network that had that iron grip on the country, once it was blown open, and rival groups sort of faced off against each other, people would continue to seek safety in their tribes and regions. So now that when you talk about Libya, you talk about Misratins, you talk about people from the east, from Barka and other places, that is because those things actually pre-existed.
Right.
And those regions and those tribes actually provided safety, protection, welfare for people in those areas. So it was natural for that to happen. That is something I don't think anybody, at least in the West, understood very, very well. Again, Libya was a huge black box. There were a few idiosyncratic academics who continued to work on Libya throughout the Gaddafi era, but very few people had access. Look, this kind of misunderstanding of the way in which this part of the world works is a chronic problem. Why do you think after a year or so in Iraq, the U.S. military went out to try to find anthropologists try to help explain this place to people?
Right.
So I think that was part of this enthusiasm and this idea that Libya could be built up, or that any of these places would make this transition relatively easily, was because there was a fundamental misunderstanding of the way in which some of these societies actually work. Again, the caveat being there's no reason to believe that any of these people can't live in democracies, but I think we vastly underestimated the obstacles to this that have nothing to do with Arab culture, have nothing to do with Muslim culture, but have to do with the kind of legacies, and this is a point that I make in the book, the legacies that previous authoritarian leaders had bequeathed to their people make it hugely, hugely problematic for those who want to live in more open and democratic society.
Yeah, I want you, because I have about sort of 2-3 questions left. What I'd like you to do is go into that a little bit more deeply. And you use Theda Skopjkal's work on, you know, revolutions, basically, and kind of like what is and isn't a revolution. Can you, you know, go deeper into those legacies from colonialism to previous dictatorships and that Skopjkal model of why these things were not, in fact, revolutions?
Do you know that it took me throughout my entire time in graduate school to figure out how to pronounce her name correctly?
Did I do it?
No.
No, not at all.
No. I'll help you out here.
Thank you.
Theda Skocpol. Theda Skocpol, who's a political sociologist.
Just like I said. Harvard. Exactly.
And she actually is, some of your listeners may know her work because she's done a lot of work actually on healthcare.
Yep.
And has appeared in like the Times and the Post and so on and so forth on the op-ed pages discussing healthcare issues. Anyway, Skocpol has a rather demanding definition of a revolution. And I think it's very useful because it provides insight into what happened in the Middle East and what didn't happen in the Middle East. And what she says is that we have to avoid thinking about revolutions purely in terms of what happened in, the kind of famous world revolutions like France and China and so on and so forth. And think about these things in terms of kind of structures. So for her, and I think it's quite powerful, a revolution is something that overthrows both the political order as well as the social structure that supports that political order. And what you see, and you see it so clearly in a place like Egypt, is that you basically had a leadership change as a result of a rebellion. So Mubarak was screwed out of his seat and sent off to Sharm el-Sheikh before he was arrested. And what came in his place was another military figure, and the social structure, the social classes that supported the system, that benefited from the system, remained intact, and the political order, that the institutions of the Egyptian state, remained intact. So if we understood revolutions the way Skocpol understands them, as this kind of undermining, this reinforcing social and political structures and orders of the country. From the very beginning, from February 12, 2011, the day after Mubarak left, and who is in charge but Field Marshal Mohammed Hussein Tantawi, right. We would have understood that this was a revolution. And in fact, there were some diehard members of Egypt's kind of polyglot group of revolutionaries who said, we should not leave Tahrir Square because this isn't what we stayed out here for 18 days for the military just to take over again. This doesn't constitute a revolution. That was very powerful to me. And that I thought about that a lot in between my last book on Egypt specifically and writing this book on the quality of these uprisings and what they really actually meant. And I think it's a very important point that we understand these as not revolutions.
Right. And that because it's not because of culture, which will be the new Western disc, it'll be because of legacy. But this is one specific and one open-ended to sort of wrap up. The other thing that strikes me, and this is a stretch, obviously, but I think these comparisons are interesting. With an American context, there's this notion of resisting Trump. Cuts across, everything from people that see a broader policy framework and like there's things that, people want to do in this society about inequality, about how we organize, wealth distribution, social safety net, how we deal with the environment. I mean, deeper structural critiques. And then there's, also just, this guy is very unpalatable to a lot of people for, I think obvious reasons. When I was, as I was reading your book, I was thinking about that and the difference in people in the square and the big emphasis in Western media was, of course, like, the young Egyptians who were, tech savvy and all the rest. And Juan Cole has a very optimistic book about the youth bulge and the trends in the Middle East that lead towards more progressive and socially open politics. That was what we emphasized, but people who wanted to be pessimists and, they emphasized this is all just a Muslim Brotherhood operation. I think what we undercovered, but what interested me was that there was a big, particularly in a place like Alexandria, there's a big labor dimension to this and the issues of stagnation and crony capitalism and inequality are massive in the Middle East. And so that said, part of the reason it seemed like it wasn't the revolution was that instead of like a congealing and of formulating together, there was just like, we need to get rid of Mubarak or we need to get rid of, fill in the blank dictator versus a structural reform package that could deal with everything from We need to be more socially open and progressive, but we also need people to be able to express their religion, and we also need to break up the sclerotic income inequality, which is also the political, you know, because it's fused there, of kind of state capture. So I guess, like, my question is it going to be moving forward, is it going to be the sort of formalization of those alliances across those concern sets that actually start to create something like, you know, I mean, like something, I don't know, like the African National Congress, right? Like, that's the kind of classic example of a group that really was able to thread workers, bourgeoisie, middle class, you know, and a lot of different issue sets into a broader kind of demand for structural change.
You know, I think that, and this is probably something I always get the question, you know, what is it that you didn't cover in your book that you would have done differently, that you would have done more of? And this kind of dynamic, what you're talking about is very important, I think, something to watch going forward, which is, what are the dynamics at the level of informal politics? Clearly, the counter-revolutionary or status quo forces have won in a place like Egypt. As I said, in Turkey, the anti-status quo forces have now appropriated the tools of the status quo forces. Libya's fragmentation, Tunisia could go either way, but to some extent, there's been a soft restoration of the old order there. So what's happening? So these groups that showed up on Habib Bourguiba Avenue in Tunis and in Tahrir Square and other places, and in Gezi Park in Turkey, they have largely been defeated,
right?
At least at that formal political game. And what are the dynamics going on at the level below that, at informal politics? What kind of manifestos are being written? What kind of coalitions are emerging that can take up what work was done and move it forward? I'm somewhat skeptical. I think that a lot of that is actually going on, and I think a lot of people in the West are missing it. I've seen glimpses of this happening, but the overwhelming power of the state and the predatory nature of the state in these settings strikes me as it's going to be hard for them to the groups at this informal level that are building coalitions and writing manifestos and planning and thinking about all of the issues that you're talking about are up against a huge, huge obstacle because of the predatory nature of these states. That's not to say that they don't have a chance, but it really would be revolutionary for them to be able to shift the politics, at least in the short run. And that's why, in the end, I'm somewhat pessimistic. Well, no, I'm profoundly pessimistic in thinking that the trajectory of the region really is authoritarian and unstable. And it's not unstable, and this is obviously different from the way in which we thought about the region for the, you know, 5 decades before the uprisings, but unstable in the sense that, for the reasons that you're getting at, that yes, the states have won, but you still have people who are mobilized and are planning and seeking change, and the state is going to respond to that, and then people are going to respond back, and the state, and so you do have an unsettled, unstable politics. Some of it may manifest itself in violence. We've already seen some of that.
Right.
But that's what I mean. It also gets to something that is actually more common in the Middle East than people don't realize, is that politics is contested in the Middle East.
Right.
People aren't these kind of docile, you know, oh, we only want stability type things. You know, in Egypt, they've been rebelling against the powers that have ruled them for a very, very long time.
Right.
So, keeping with this theme, the future is authoritarian and unstable. It's kind of weird to put those two things together. That's the way I think we should think about it going forward.
Well, the book is really important if you're looking to understand this part of the world and maybe potentially how we can stop effing it up from our perspective.
There is a big chapter, as you know, on the U.S., and it's called, in a sarcastic way, getting the Middle East right.
Exactly.
And it's more about what we shouldn't do than what we actually should do when it comes to these countries and the region more broadly.
Yeah, that's yes. Let's follow the precautionary principle. The book is False Dawn, Protest, Democracy, and Violence in the New Middle East, or New Middle East. Stephen Cook, my buddy from the Council on Foreign Relations, I appreciate it. And people, Steve and I have more snarky articles we're working on together, so be ready.
Looking forward to it, Michael. Thanks for the time.
Oh, thank you so much. All right, talk to you soon, man. Bye.
I'll see you. Bye.
Okay, everybody, running a little behind. We're going to be right back with Avi Asher Shapiro on the harassment of women drivers for Uber.
Hey, I remember syrup sandwiches and crime allowances, finessing on them with some counterfeits, but now I'm counting this Parmesan where my accountant lives. In fact, I'm down in this. You say with my boobie tastes like Kool-Aid for the analyst. Girl, I can buy your Westie girl with my base stuff. I know that it's good, won't you sit it on my taste buds? I get way too petty, won't you let me do the extras? Pull up on your block and break it down, we playing Tetris. AM to the PM, PM to the AM funk. Eat up your per diem, you just gotta hate them funk. If I quit your BM, I still rock Mercedes funk. If I quit this season, I still be the greatest funk. My left stroke just went viral. Right stroke, put a baby in a spiral. Soprano C, we like to keep it on the high note. It's levels to it, you and I know. Tell them be humble.
Hold up.
Sit down.
Hold up.
Be humble.
Hold up.
Sit down.
Sit down.
Be humble.
Hold up.
Sit down. Be humble. Sit down. Be humble. Sit down. Be humble.
Welcome back to the Majority Report. I'm Michael Brooks. Joining us now is Avi Asher Shapiro. He's an independent investigative journalist based in New York City. His recent piece in The Intercept, as Uber probes sexual harassment at its offices, it overlooks hundreds of thousands of female drivers. Avi, how are you doing?
Good, man. Thanks for having me.
It's my pleasure. I'm going to just quote, actually, from the beginning of your piece, because it's pretty stunning. In 2012... Sure. Shortly after Uber started operating in Los Angeles, Rachel Galindo bought a new car and signed up as a driver. She had worked as a journeyman carpenter, but contractors who used to hire her stopped calling after she transitioned her gender. Driving for Uber, Galindo hoped to avoid transphobia. After all, the company's old billboard made the tantalizing promise, "Be your own boss," quote unquote. The harassment began almost immediately. On three separate occasions, she said passengers got into her car without saying anything else and simply said, "How much for a BJ?" Another passenger kept referring to her as "it" during the ride, and when Galindo asked her to stop, the passengers responded, "Well, I just don't know who you are." She repeatedly complained to Uber about such incidents. Take us from there. How did Uber respond to her complaints?
Yeah, sure. So Rachel shared with me her correspondence with Uber, which was through their app and through sort of emails connected to their app. And basically, you know, it's an automated system, or it's, there's, you know, Uber has employees that sort of give canned responses or what seem to be sort of predetermined answers to drivers' questions. So when a driver like Rachel is facing harassment in her car and feels unsafe at times, the sorts of responses she's getting from Uber, you know, just don't measure up to the severity, or in her mind, just didn't measure up to the severity of the situation. She would get, you know, "Thank you for your concern. Thanks for being a professional driver. Sometimes, you know, every ride isn't an optimum ride. You know, all drivers have to be flexible." These sorts of things, sort of like boilerplate, the kinds of responses you get if you like submit a complaint, like on a website or something, like, not the sort of thing that you would expect to get from, the company you work for after you've been sexually harassed by a customer. This went on for several years. The reason why this was a particular concern to Rachel, I mean, she's no snowflake. I mean, she's been through a lot of tough stuff. She dealt with a lot of harassment. What she was particularly concerned with was that these riders would give her a low rating. Uber, every driver gets a rating out of 5 stars, and Uber is pretty tough. If your average falls below a couple percent percentage points below perfect, you can lose your job, you know, or you can get froze out of
the
system.
Explain and explain what losing. So if you're so on the rating systems in Uber, if you get any, and it's a 5-point system, right?
Yeah.
So if you so explain what happens, like what is getting quote unquote fired from Uber actually mean?
Yeah, so you can just get a note that says, hey, your average has fallen below, you know, so it changes city to city and like time to time. Like Uber, it's not like 4.8, you get fired. It's sort of a dynamic system. It's like the average on a weekly basis, aggregated over a month. Like Uber's not super transparent about exactly what a rating that disqualifies you is, but if you get enough ratings that are low, and it is something around 4.6, 4.7, so it's not like, we're not talking about a rating that's like an average of a 1. We're talking about like a B+.
Right.
Plus,
right.
Like
if you
get below like a B+, plus, at a certain point, you know, and I've talked to lots of drivers who have had this happen to them. Uber will just send you a note and be like, listen, your quality is not high enough. You can no longer drive for us. And there's, you know, there's some options to rehabilitate yourself, but they're not free. You know, you can go and take like a driving course with Uber. You can pay them to give you like a sort of how to be more polite as a rider.
How to accept sexual harassment. No, I'm just kidding.
Right. Well, who knows?
Right.
I mean,
right.
So you can dispute these ratings as you're a driver. You can say like, hey, I didn't do anything wrong. I shouldn't have gotten a low star rating for this. But you know, this is obviously an exhausting process. You're trying to work, you're driving around and you notice you get a low star rating and you have to like type an email to Uber to dispute it. And it's going through an automated system where, you know, there's no personal touch, you know, there's no way you're going to ever get anyone on the phone, to explain yourself. And, you know, I've seen a lot of these back and forth emails, between drivers and the company, and they're, you know, they're impersonal, and it's what you'd expect from a company that has hundreds of thousands of people driving for them. They're probably fielding, you know, thousands of complaints a day. You know, it's not, there's no easy fix here. But the point is that in the case of female drivers, they're in a particularly tough spot because,
right,
on the one hand, their Ubers, you know, got them alone in a car with a strange man. But they, you know, if they're in an uncomfortable situation, potentially a place where they could be hit on or someone could be intimidating them, and they don't have an easy recourse through the company to, you know, dispute a rating or, you know, figure out, they can, for example, submit a complaint about the passenger. This guy made me feel unsafe.
Mm-hmm.
But there's no system for them to follow up and appeal or figure out if the company has banned that person from the platform, what kind of, get any answers about what kind of investigation has taken place. I mean, this Uber sort of has their own, does whatever they want. They have their own prerogative sort of follow up on these complaints. And
so,
they're not particularly transparent about what they do on the back end.
Yeah. So, I mean, it's really just, it fits the pattern of, and I think that this is like what we're discovering with all aspects of this, you know, the gig economy, the tech economy, all of these platforms, there's always the kind of, you know, it's the frowny emoji that's concealed behind the smiley emoji, if I could do a disgusting analogy like that, right? It's the kind of like, be your own boss, have complete freedom, work as a contractor. The corollary of that is there's no protection for you in this job. We don't have serious mechanisms around sexual harassment. We can change your price structure at any point. That's
sure.
The corollary of there's no, you know, collective nature to this. So it's sold as very empowering, but actually, you know, you're just an isolated subject to a massive, you know, corporate behemoth. But we're going to get to, because this is obviously a bigger problem at Uber specifically as a company, but there's a gender dimension and a class dimension. But before we get to that, did she ever, after years of talking about this, did she ever receive any type of actual response, like human response?
Yeah, so she says that I think she would go for Uber for about 4 years,
right,
where she kind of continuously submitted complaints about transphobia, particularly, and, you know, from passengers, and worrying that she was on the verge of losing her job because of low ratings from passengers who were biased against her. And she says that 3 years into a regular round of complaints, she did receive a phone call from a manager at Uber who checked in on her. Mm-hmm. So it took about 3 years. Uber, you know, I spoke with Uber extensively for this investigation, and all they would say about Rachel's case, because, you know, Rachel bravely, you know, I spoke to a lot of women for this piece, but
right.
but Rachel is the only one who was willing to use her real name because she no longer drives for Uber.
Right.
But all the other women, you know, are not trying to provoke the wrath of the company. So
right.
I wasn't able to ask Uber specifically about their names and their the instances of harassment that they had raised to me because I didn't want to get them in trouble. But Rachel was okay with that. So, you know, I brought this to Uber and I showed them the documentation. And they said to me that the instances that she had raised had been investigated. But they wouldn't tell me what that investigation entailed or what that really meant.
Right.
It's up to us to imagine what that means for Uber. So it's very possible that some of these passengers who were, you know, harassing her were kicked off the Uber platform. Like,
mm-hmm.
that's totally possible. Uber didn't say that happened, but they said that they do that in cases where they have determined that someone is, you know, a serial harasser. But
right.
Drivers are not able to, you know, get that information. That's something that Uber does, you know, behind closed doors. So, that's where she's no longer driving with Uber, and she, the impetus for this piece was, back in February, Susan Fowler, who was
right.
an engineer at Uber, went public with what was, you know, a pretty harrowing tale of gender-based discrimination and sexual harassment at Uber's corporate headquarters.
Right.
And Uber responded to that, you know, in a really swift and sort of decisive way. They hired Eric Holder to investigate. They brought board RN Huffington, who's a board member of Uber, sort of quarterback the PR response. And there was a massive
supposedly
kind of
Travis
campaign.
Kalanick started crying at a company-wide meeting. There was
exactly.
There was a lot of melodrama and a lot of gnashing of teeth. Though again, if you read Susan Fowler's original post, I mean, clearly on, I mean, we can say with certitude if her story is correct, and no one, and obviously not only have they not denied it, in fact, they've jumped up into action around it, just as you're outlining. I mean, there was a policy there not a formal policy, but essentially a woman who was an engineer who had a very good position at Uber. She reported, sexual harassment, sexual propositioning from her boss, her immediate leader, to human resources, and she was essentially told that, well, the only move now is for you to, like, go to another team because you've burned that bridge. There wasn't even, like,
right. If it happened the way she said it happened,
yeah.
like, that's completely illegal.
Like, totally
right?
illegal.
So, like,
right.
Right. So she, and Uber knows that. I mean, it's not only illegal, it's tremendously embarrassing for the company.
Right.
So, you know, they sprung into action, and there's been a multi-month-long investigation that's still underway, headed by Eric Holder and Covington Burling, his law firm.
Right, but this is...
which...
Yeah, go ahead, sorry.
So by all accounts, you know, there's no way... The findings from this investigation and review of their sexual harassment and gender-based discrimination policies is thrown underway. But, you know, sort of the scoop in my story and what no one else had reported yet was that... you know, Uber told me that review does not extend to those drivers like Rachel and their experiences.
Right. And that's the class and employment dimension of it. And Galindo told you herself that she sees parallels between her experience and Susan's, and she's glad that the things are moving forward, but she's also, like, you know, heartbroken that, well, maybe, you know, illegal behavior, gender discrimination and abuse, maybe we can sort of understand after being embarrassed that that's wrong to treat an engineer that way. But what, drivers, I mean, what? I mean, that's how it comes off in the story.
Yeah, so I mean, so there's a couple important distinctions, right? I mean, first of all, there's a legal distinction, which is that, you know, Rachel was not an employee of the company. You know, she's an independent contractor.
Right. Right.
I mean, there are... That doesn't mean that the company doesn't have any liability. I mean, there's in a lot of states, including California, some workplace-based discrimination statutes do extend to independent contractors and specific purposes. But by and large, she's in a much weaker position as an independent contractor
versus employee. And the second thing, which is an important distinction, I think also, is that, you know, what happened to Susan Fowler was that people, other employees of the company were treating her, as she says, you know, unfairly because of her gender.
Right.
What's happened with Rachel and the women drivers I'm talking about is customers, right?
Right.
So, you know, it's important. That's an important distinction. And you know, you have to be fair-minded and recognize that, you know, people who work in customer service deal with, you know, rude and inappropriate and harassing customers. Like, that's just going to happen in customer service and driving. The question right. that, you know, I want to raise with Uber is that, you know, they have a kind of unique set of tools at their disposal. They have the personal information of all of their passengers. They have a tremendous amount of data that they're soaking up about everyone who uses that platform. And unlike a Starbucks, they can actually, like, decide who gets to use their platform. I mean,
right.
You can't like bar someone from a Starbucks, but you can kick people off the Uber app who are harassers or inappropriate towards women.
Yeah, I mean, Uber's more analogous to being a member of like a gym or like a private club than Starbucks in the sense
yeah,
that
totally,
it's, yeah,
totally, right?
So
you would imagine, or you could, one could hope and that with all of the resources that Uber has and the sort of new frontier of this employment relationship and this customer and the relationship between the customer and the driver, that Uber would marshal these new resources to create a safe work environment to the best of their ability for their women drivers, right? I mean, that's one could hope or expect that, or at least that's what the women I spoke to would have hoped for Uber, given that they spend, you know, hundreds of millions of dollars investing in driverless cars or in, you know, like mapping technology. But it seems like there's been really no commensurate investment in creating a safe work environment for the people that generate money for the company.
So that's
sort of, you know, an important distinction here. You know, I talked to a lot of employment right. lawyers for this piece, and, you know, they told me, like, legally, women like Rachel are in a really tough spot. You know, I mean, it's hard to build a case that Uber has done anything illegal here and not responding to their complaints adequately. Or at least in their mind, adequately. I mean, it's tough because they're these independent contractors and they're talking about customers. But I think, you know, everyone I spoke to said that Uber's policies surrounding this didn't demonstrate serious concern or effort made to make the female drivers comfortable at the company. And I think that that's an important distinction from the Fowler case. But, you know, it's endemic of the precarious work situation these women find themselves in. I mean, they have very few legal protection.
I think that, to me, and maybe this is Uber's answer, would be that we are dealing with the problem by investing in driverless cars because we're going to eliminate all of our contractors over the next couple of years, so nobody will be harassed. But I do
sure,
think,
yeah, that's an important part of my piece, right? I mean, a lot of women just quit. You know, Uber's labor model, to a large extent, kind of relies on the churn. A huge portion of their drivers sign up, try it out, make some money for Uber, decide that it's really not a great job, or they're making below minimum wage, or the passengers are harassing them for whatever reason, and they quit. And that's no skin off Uber's back, because they have zero startup costs. Every driver buys their own car, runs their own gas, right? So, like, for every additional driver driving for Uber, doesn't cost Uber a cent. So from their perspective, it really doesn't matter if their drivers stay or leave, as long as they keep driving, or that they keep attracting new drivers.
Right. So we need to really, I mean, I think ultimately this becomes a new question of, you know, what are the labor rights and organizing and policy models for dealing with this in today's tech environment. But the piece is, as Uber probes sexual harassment at its offices, it overlooks hundreds of thousands of female drivers. It's in The Intercept. We have a link to it. Avi Asher Shapiro, thanks for joining me, man. I appreciate your time.
Hey, thanks. Anytime.
All right, everybody, we are going to get to the fun half where there's sound, there's stories, there's your calls at 646. Sorry?
Did you bump your mic there?
Did I bump my mic there?
Your mic, sorry, just cut out. Something happened.
How is this?
We're better.
We're good? Yeah, your IMs, your calls, become a member of the Majority Report today, become a member. That's me calling it the phone system, obviously. Fresh Two Dope Boys dropped today. We make fun of the Fyre Festival. Play Ja Rule. That show is also growing. Thank you, everybody, for all of your support. We are going to see you in the fun half. 646-257-3920.